And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from an undisclosed location at the home of Eric Kareen of The Athletic, where it is time for an annual holiday tradition. Zach goes to Toronto and talks about the Raptors and World Junior Hockey and other basketball things with Eric Kareen of The Athletic, who supplied me with tea. Thank you.
You're welcome. We have many selections here at Shea Kareen.
And a dog and a cat.
Yes, there could be hijinks. Animal hijinks. Has there ever been animal hijinks?
Never. Not one animal has ever appeared on this podcast, unless you count Howard Beck. And Bruce Arthur of the Toronto Star, how are you, sir?
I'm really happy to be in the house of Eric and Andy. It's a lovely place.
There's cookies, candies.
Skittles,
are
yeah.
out. Skittles. Skittles are gross. Is that, that's not even a hot take. Skittles are just gross.
They were bought for me. My wife does not partake in it. I am more of the candy fiend, and she likes chocolate in general more. I don't love Skittles. I would say if we were to not buy one of the things that we bought for Jewish Christmas, which came after actual Christmas, it would have been, we could have excised the Skittles, I think.
Skittles are great. They're just very childlike. That's all.
Skittles are disgusting.
You have to you have to brush your teeth immediately.
It's like Orange Crush, right? Like Orange Crush is objectively way too sweet and ridiculous. It's a cartoon drink, but it's still pretty good. Still pretty good.
Okay, let's not talk anymore about cookies. We're in Toronto. The Raptors finally, after years of agitation and angst and woe is us, the league doesn't like us because we're in Canada, got their Christmas game, got the noon game, which is kind of like the FU, we don't really want you on Christmas game, and promptly got destroyed by the Celtics. But let us not dwell on that. The Toronto Raptors are 21-10. In the loss column, they're tied for fourth in the East. They're actually sixth in the East. I think, A, Kawhi left. B, Lowry and Ibaka were hurt at the same time. C, Powell, Gasol, and Siakam are now all hurt at the same time. Mm-hmm. When Lowry and Ibaka went down, I thought they have now reached a critical mass of injuries. Pascal's playing unbelievable, all this. They just don't have enough guys, and they just keep winning games. They unearth the Bouchers and the Terrence Davises and all of this. I go to you as my, you guys live here. Like, what are you, either of you surprised how good the team is? I mean, particularly once the injury, I mean, I thought they would be like a nice 48 win team, and then all the injuries happened, and I thought, boy, this could go south fast.
I didn't think they could survive a major injury to either Lowry or Siakam. I thought if that happened, this was now it's the Eastern Conference, so if you get a particularly friendly portion of the schedule, which in large part they did in the Lowry Ibaka period of absence, you could survive. But if that were to prolong and you're to get a stretch like they have now, or even the stretch that they had just after the Lowry or Ibaka returns, it was going to be trouble. But I think that first West Coast trip, the first game against New Orleans is when Kyle Lowry and Serge Ibaka both hurt themselves. And the next game, they go out and beat the Lakers. I mean, that sort of sets the tone. And they played so hard that game. It was like, the arena wasn't a playoff atmosphere, but their level of effort was. And that sort of becomes their trademark, I think, is this is a team who it's going to take a lot for this team to quit on a game.
Yeah, I actually thought they had a chance to be a really good team, because I thought that even without Kawhi and Danny Green, who's the guy we never talk about that they lost.
They lost their wing rotation, other than obviously to get down and Obi back, but they lost 75% of their minutes on the wing. Gone.
And two really high-end defenders, because Danny's still a high-end defender. I still thought that this team could be good because they, as a team, still can defend at a high level, and because I thought they would have enough and they would play hard enough to get through the season. And even I didn't think that they had the upper level that they've shown at times. And I think that what Kareen talked about, those two games in LA, like the Clippers game, that's a tough place to play on the second night of a back-to-back. And they played really well in that game and made it a contest. There's a championship DNA in this team, and it's the simplest thing in the world to see and say. But the way they play, the levels they can go to in terms of playing hard, the way they know what each other are supposed to be doing, the confidence you can see in Kyle Lowry, in Pascal Siakam, in Norm Powell at times, although he's always been a little overconfident.
He's playing, this is what a weird career he's had.
Yes.
From like random playoff spark plug to signs the contract, there are high hopes, to, oh, crushing disappointment, not really doing that much in the playoffs, to all of a sudden, he's averaging like 15 a game and shooting the hell out of it and appears essential.
Quietly, he shot 40% from three last year. Like, he was better than we thought last year.
And it's so strange, because if you watch his shot a lot, which I've had the pleasure to do, like, it looks in real time like he's releasing his shot on the way down. There's like a bit of a hitch in his shot. And yet, if he levels out at 38% or 40%, then that's obviously a great place to be.
I'm laughing because Walter, who is Kareen's beautiful dog, just pulled
a chocolate croissant
right out of my Zach's bag. So we did get animal hijinks.
Chocolate croissant.
Good job, everybody.
Frankly, you can have it.
Walter ate a chocolate Timbit the other day.
Do all dogs die from chocolate? Is that just a total? It's universal dog.
I don't know. If you ingest, like, chocolate Timbits are hardly chocolate, so he's been. It's like a sprinkling of.
I didn't know that. They're
allergic to chocolate, and if they have it, you better take them to the vet to get their stomach pumped.
Were either of you guys at the Mavs game?
I was not.
So I was asking a couple of the players yesterday, including Kyle, like, when you're down 30 in the third quarter, and then you come back with this full court press, then the Mavericks are like, they're not the first team to react like this to it, but they're one of the first to act like they've never seen it before. And you win the game. Not only do you win, you tie it up in like 8 minutes. Was there anything in the huddle? Like, did anyone say anything? And they're like, everyone I talked to was like, no. Nick was just like, I think we're going to press now, throw him a different look. And everyone's like, yeah, let's go do it. There's just a certain calm steeliness that I guess when you win a championship, you have to have some of it to win a championship. But then when you win it, then you have way too much of it almost.
Their loss in Philadelphia this year was one of their first sort of blowout losses, but in that game they pressed near the end and they cut the lead from like 20-6 or something like that. And at that point it's easy to say, well, the other team had taken the foot off the gas, but like it was giving Philadelphia, who's, you know, not deep in ball creator in creators with the ball, it gave them problems. And Dallas, without Luka Doncic, like that.
We should say that he didn't play, although they've been fantastic with him.
Yeah, like they had DeLon Wright out there for a lot of it. They had Jalen Brunson out there for a lot of it, but it just wasn't enough. And what Nick Nurse said, according to him, was, let's just go out and try this for 3 minutes. They were down 23 after the third quarter. It's like, let's see what happens. And Kyle's minutes were creeping up. But if you cut it to a reasonable number, we're going to keep doing it. And there was one moment in that game, they'd created a few turnovers, and then Malcolm Miller stole a pass, like sort of the third pass out of the trap. He stole it at half court, passed it to Terrence Davis, and Terrence Davis like barely touches the ball before taking like a three-pointer from sort of just beyond the elbow, and it went in to cut the lead at 13. And it was at that point where I was like, they have a chance here. Like, that was a weird ass play, and for it to like work, it's like maybe the stars can align.
One thing when I was talking about the people with increased confidence, because you can see it on this team, like guys really, there's an extra level of belief in a lot of guys, including guys who are rookies. Terrence Davis has that, and Nick Nurse has that. Think it's not just that they won a championship, it's that they won this championship. It was really hard. And there were so many moments when you go back that tested this team. Game 3 in Philadelphia, they get blown out. The game 4 in Philadelphia is their whole season's on the line. Game 3 against Milwaukee, their whole season's on the line. Game 7 against Philadelphia, playing the Warriors. Like, over and over they had to do this. And so Nick is like my high school coach at the highest level. Let's press sometimes. Let's play zones. Let's play a 2-3. Let's play a 1-3-1. Let's shoot 33s a game. That's what my high school coach did. And the guys know that he's in charge.
He's a really, I think Nick Nurse has proven himself to be one of the, I don't want to put a number, but half dozen or more best coaches in the league. He's legit. And I should talk to the players about this. It'd probably be boring for them. I wonder if they liked the game plan they had against Harden and the Rockets, which was like a variation on the trapping that everyone is doing, but it was early on in the, everyone's going to trap Harden. because they did some really creative stuff in that game. They didn't just trap Harden with whoever happened to be setting a screen for him, that guy's defender, whatever. They designated Fred VanVleet for a lot of the game as you're just going to be at half court and you're going to meet him there. And just that simple adjustment of, we don't care who's around Harden, we don't care what actions they run, our trap is you. It really mucked up a lot of the ways that Houston gets around those traps. And I've had several coaches reach out to me because I wrote a piece on the trapping, being like, tell me more about what Nick did, or is there like coaches, and Steve Kerr mentioned it yesterday on Christmas when the Warriors beat the Rockets. How did that happen, by the way? Toronto did some really interesting stuff. Like the coaches around the league are watching a lot of the creative stuff that he does.
Well, and it's a lot of it's simple, right? Like pressing and zones, that's grade school stuff. It's high school stuff, but he's executing it at such a high level. Like, it's awesome.
And part of it's from necessity. Like right now, for example, they're mostly zoning when Serge Ibaka isn't on the floor, and that's because their backup bigs are Chris Boucher, who I might outweigh, and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, who's 6'7". Like that. So when they're going up against Addis Kanter or Sabonis at Indiana, like, you gotta try some things. And I've always thought that one of Nick Nurse's best qualities is he's not afraid. Like the Rockets hit a bunch of corner threes in that game as a result of that trapping, and as a result of them being pretty damn good. And he's not afraid for something to fail in terms of a result-based way, especially in the regular season. He wasn't afraid to look stupid with the box and one. Like, there was a Kevin Durant comment I think it was with Serge Ibaka, and he said that Nick Nurse wasn't the best X's and O's coach, but he knows how to put you in position to win, which doesn't make sense as a comment. Like, putting you in position to win is exactly what X's and O's are. Like, the X's represent people who are in certain places. So, but that's the thing. He's not, like, you can call this minor league janky stuff, but the Raptors are champions, and now they're outperforming sort of the talent on their roster.
Well, but they have good play. One of the things that they've done, and this is a credit both to the players and to the front office, like, and I feel like the acquisition of Marc Gasol, which was at the time, I wondered, is this really that necessary? Like, they're kind of rolling with this Ibaka Valanciunas two-headed monster, but they saw something, and one of the things they saw was that Gasol is going to be the tipping point where we go from a B passing team to an A-plus passing team. And that has proven so right, and that has carried over to this year. They have some of the most beautiful bam, 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 everyone touches the ball in 4 seconds passing sequences in the whole league. And, like, the guys off the bench, Chris Boucher can pump and drive and make the next pass. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, for his herky-jerky, he looks like a video game glitch. Like, he gets places and he makes the next pass. Terrence Davis has been good. Anunoby has reached a totally new level as a playmaker. Like, they play, this front office has found not just tough, competitive, gritty guys, smart guys who, when you put them all together, there's like this explosive compound effect where they all make each other even smarter. And, like, some of the but it's less so now with Gasol injured. But they really moved the ball beautifully. And Kyle, with these hit-ahead passes, it's like reached a different level with him the last couple of years.
Part of it is that they developed a player development system as part of their kind of giant player development system, which is a huge part of the kind of championship culture of this team. But at the lower levels, when guys are coming, when they're playing at the 905, they were drilled to move the ball, to shoot from the right spots, to like, and so all of that, the guys come up with that DNA, and Kyle's just a really smart player too. Like, we've talked about this before on this podcast. Kyle has very few physical gifts which make him valuable in the NBA. His strength is pretty much it. But his brain is all world. And so there's just, with this Raptors team last year, they had so many smart guys, and Gasol was a huge part of that. Gasol came into this year and his legs were dead, right? Because he plays 100 games in the NBA, plays all the way to June, he plays for the Spanish team. He comes in and he's tried, but he's still so valuable to what they do. He's shooting 35%, I think, before he got hurt. And he still does, he does 50 things, little things in any game that make you better. And Kyle's a guy like that. And that's a part of why the Raptors are who they are.
I would like to thank the front office for acquiring Marc Gasol for me. Cause like, you know, I'm in Toronto, mostly covering a lot of Eastern Conference basketball. So I've seen Gasol, obviously, and I've seen him in some big series, but to watch him every day, like, we were sort of already spoiled with Lowry and sort of the next level intelligence things he does. Watching Gasol just, you know, sort of, you know, whether it's defensive and he's calling out a play before it happens, or it's offensive and he sees what's going to transpire. It's, he's just, he's a wonder to watch day in and day out, even as he's, you know, gone from his peak scoring days and as he's exhausted. This hamstring injury might actually end up being a good thing if they can weather this storm. And it's a storm. Like, it's hard to compete without three of your top six or seven.
Well, they are, as good a story as they've been, the top six in the East is really good. Mm-hmm. And they're like a three-game losing streak away from being like, maybe not a distant sixth, but like a solid sixth. And they are going to have to decide, if they haven't already, if they hang around and they're where they are now, which is essentially there is no difference between third and sixth, then I think it's a much easier way to talk yourself into, hey, you know, let's just run this through the whole season. But if they fall into like a solid sixth, a real sixth, I do think my senses and teams around the league share this sense that they haven't closed the door on at least talking about, are we really, really good enough? My personal opinion is this: if they get everybody back, if everyone's healthy, Siakam was fifth on my MVP ballot before he got hurt. So, I mean, obviously he's a huge piece. If they get everyone healthy, I don't think they can win the East. Because I don't this is a weird way of saying it. I think they can beat anyone in the East in a playoff series, maybe even the Bucks, but I don't think they can win three in a row. Even at full strength, I don't think they're good enough to get out of the East. But to me, that team that I just described is good enough that you take the victory lap. It's good enough that you ride with it into the playoffs. But the scenario that's looming there is if they fall a little bit where there's a gap in the standings, and that path becomes, well, it's a 6-3 and we don't have home court, and then it's like a 6-2 and we don't have court. You know, it's at least a conversation.
This is such an interesting question because it's about what's worth something in sports, right? Winning a championship is obviously number one. So once you've done that, how much is contention worth for a team that wasn't expected to contend? And by that, I mean, you get to the second round, you get to a game seven, let's see what happens, right? Against a Philadelphia or a Milwaukee. What's that worth to the Raptors going forward versus what is it worth to break up that team? And if you break it up, this team has two bigs and they're both free agents, right? Gasol and Ibaka, that's it. They have a replacement for Kyle Lowry on the court in terms of Fred VanVleet. But what Kyle's doing this year and the emotional bond he has built with this city is so powerful. What's that worth if you move him away? And it's a huge question for Masai Ujiri to answer. We know he's ruthless enough to do it. And you know that he is considering both possibilities because he always does.
The other teams in the league, my prediction, it's in my 35 random predictions column for the year, is that they do not trade Lowry. And they essentially stand pat. Because I based it on two things. Number one, I thought they were going to be too good. And that has proven true. And number two, it's going to have to be a good offer. Like, I just don't think the Raptors are going to trade a franchise icon for like an expiring contract from the Heat and a crappy 2025 first round pick.
No,
it's a price. It has to be, especially when you're a team that's like, okay, so we traded Kyle Lowry. We got, let's say it's the 25th pick in 2024. Every year we're finding rotation players without even having a draft pick. Mm-hmm. Like what that pick is like it's totally non-essential to us. So I just don't know that there's going to be a team that makes them to me, it's more about the offer.
Yeah.
Like I bet they value contending for a championship more than anything else. I bet if they got a great deal, I don't know. I really don't. But if they got a great offer, they would have to think about it. But I just don't know that offer is coming.
That's cool. Sort of where I am. Like, especially with Lowry, if we want to focus on him more than either of Gasol or Serge Ibaka. First of all, Lowry makes $32, $33 million.
There's that too.
So you gotta add up a lot of contracts, and the Raptors don't want to take on any money after 2021 because they're signing Giannis. there's that. And this is the greatest player in franchise history. Everybody sort of agrees on this now. You're gonna trade him again for a first round pick down the line. Like, if the championship that they had last year meant enough that the chance to, even if it's not a full-on serious repeat bid, the chance to defend it and the chance to, you know, be knocked out as like honorable champions, I think that matters to the fan base. It matters to the front office.
I would assume that's what fans want.
And there's not going to be something that is more valuable than that available. I just don't see it.
And what you said, Zach, I think is really interesting. The idea that they can win. I think in the organization, there is a belief that if this team is healthy, they can beat anyone in the East in a playoff series.
And let me just be clear, because I don't want to disparage the Bucks fans, so to get the Bucks fans angry. Mm-hmm. I would pick the Bucks to beat the Raptors.
Sure.
I think the Bucks full strength versus the Raptors full strength, the Bucks probably win that series 80 to 90% of the time. But 20% is a lot. 20% or 50%, that's a big, like, there's a universe in which the Raptors do win that series. But the Raptors, before everyone was hurt, had like the fourth best net rating in the whole league. All the evidence suggested this is not a cute, frisky team. It's actually a really good team.
And there's also that outside scenario with what if Philly and Milwaukee, because Philly doesn't care about winning games, it seems, for a lot of the season. If Philly and Milwaukee play in the second round and you only got to play one of them, those are the two teams I think that the Raptors would worry about in the East.
By the way, this is, again, Boston is awesome.
They're
Boston
good.
Boston is way better than expectations. Miami is legit. I don't think they're as much of a contender as their record indicates, but they're really good. Mm-hmm. Indiana is really good. They have the Oladipo wild card. Like, all these teams are really good. I just don't know that you can stack each of them, despite what happened yesterday on Christmas. And again, all those players are injured. I don't know that you can stack them up next to Toronto and say, well, that's an easy series for Boston. That's an easy series for Philadelphia. I don't think you can say that.
Well, and so they do believe that they can compete with their championship DNA, with the talent they've got, when rotations are down to eight guys in the playoffs, that they can match up. The funny part is, Marc Gasol would look great in Boston, right? And Kyle Lowry would look great in Miami.
Everywhere.
Yeah, like, Kyle, lots of places.
Kyle fits so easily around anything. Yeah. It's
and the Raptors, maybe that works in some, if Masai is ruthless enough. But I do think that I think there's a huge amount of currency in being the defending champs and cementing your bond to this city and this country in terms of, if you talk to Raptors fans this year, they have loved cheering for this team. They've loved it more than they loved it last year because they're the underdogs again. And it's been like, I've talked to so many who've just said, it's so rewarding. Cause like that Christmas Day game was kind of the first one where you really saw the limits. Like, and they were beat to
the
hell,
Clippers
right?
game in Toronto.
Yeah, that one too. Yeah, you're right. But this team doesn't cheat you.
No.
Right? Almost any night. And this is a league where there's 20 games that are schedule losses for almost everybody. And these guys have erased a lot of those schedule losses in terms of just effort.
Plus you being around here reminded me, like, Van Vliet is beloved here. Like, people just love that guy because he's got such big balls and just talks the talk and walks the walk. And Siakam is like, Siakam's your guy. Like, Siakam is the Raptors picked him. He's when you pick a guy in the first round low and he develops into a player like this in this city, like he was unbelievable before he got hurt.
Van Vliet's free agency is going to be very interesting.
So interesting.
That team across the lake in Detroit, I think we'll take a hard look at him.
Does anybody want Norm Powell? Does anybody want Norm Powell right now? Like, honestly, when Norm was on that run, and you think this, of course, with lots of players, sell him high. Sell him where you can put him on a team and get that number, that player option off the books, or keep him and hope he does this all season so that he declines his player option. Like, those are the two scenarios with Norm, because Norm is the biggest impediment in that salary cap jumble.
The art of trading a player at the right time is so hard and a lot of times out of your control, but just the only trade we've had since Russell Westbrook brought that up, and that's not the XM. The Jazz just clung to him for too long. They traded him at the absolute lowest point of his value. They could have traded him earlier, and I understand why. He's the fifth pick. He's the highest pick they have that they made as a front office on that roster, and it's just hard to give up on a guy like that. Let's talk about the other Eastern Conference Christmas game yesterday and use that as a tangent to get into other things. Of all the Christmas Day games, I was most excited for Philadelphia-Milwaukee because that's the series. I want that series in the playoffs. I think it's a fascinating matchup of fit versus talent. You got the two Spurs coaches going against each other. You got Giannis calling Simmons a f***ing baby. during a game last year, and like there's clear, and they, anytime Embiid is involved with another star player, God only knows what will happen. And I just think that's a fascinating matchup, and I'm endlessly fascinated by the Sixers. You take it through the lens of Toronto if you want. Like, what Milwaukee, I feel like we know what they are. Philadelphia is a mystery that is evolving. Like, what do you what do you think, either one of you, that those teams look like in May or June?
I think same as you. I had Philly Clippers in my NBA finals, and I just, maybe it's my reaction to watching that series between the Raptors and the Sixers last year, but they're just so big. And so from the Toronto perspective, it's like, yeah, we're good, but two of our four best players are Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet, and they eliminated one of them last year, and Kyle didn't have his best series by any stretch. And I just think there's so much skill there, and if they could find a way to add, you know, one shooter who can, you know, be decent on the other end of the floor, which is very difficult, I realize. They were the most intriguing team to me, and even though they've been sort of a mess sometimes, I still think I would take them over the Bucks. Not with a lot of confidence. The Bucks are awesome, but I think I'd take them. Whereas Milwaukee, again, like, they seem like this team who's just wrecking the competition, and are almost fully formed, and that worries me. Because I've seen some very, now they have Giannis, and Giannis is different than whatever any fully formed Toronto team that was excellent in the regular season ever had. But if you're playing this well in the regular season, and you have one star, like, what, Chris maybe, Middleton might make an all-star team.
He's not maybe one all-star.
He's not a star, though. He's a very, very, very good complimentary player. That just worries me come the playoff time, because a team like the Sixers is going to have a lot of options to throw at Giannis. Nobody can stop him, except maybe Embiid.
Well, but, that to me was the takeaway from that game. Because remember what, go back to the Raptors for a second. Remember what Pascal Siakam ran through in the playoffs last year.
This is incredible.
Jonathan Isaac in the first round. Jonathan Isaac is a problem in the future, right? Like, Jonathan Isaac is defensively
an all defense team this year.
He might. Second round, here's Joel Embiid. Third round, you get Giannis. And by the way, in the finals, you get Draymond Green. And I asked him, what was the difference between Giannis and Embiid? And he said, the difference between Giannis is I might be able to move him. If I get him off balance and I get a shoulder into him, I might be able to move him a little bit and create some space. With Embiid, I just bounce off him. And if when what you saw in that Christmas Day game, it was fascinating watching Embiid guard Giannis. Because the thing that Siakam ran up against with those two guys is, these guys are bigger than me. And all my tricks, like 70% of them, disappear all of a sudden. And Embiid is one of the few guys in the world who's bigger than Giannis and can stay with him. And that is a fascinating nuclear weapon to have.
I said this on a couple podcasts ago. Embiid, when Embiid is engaged and in shape, he is the most impactful and best defensive player in the NBA.
Yep.
And I mean, it's close because you're, but I, to me, it's clear. Mm-hmm. And yesterday was one of those games where it's like, there's nothing you can do around the rim.
Nothing.
When he's in the game.
What happened in that Raptors series is when Embiid was within 15 feet of the rim, the Raptors weren't.
And
like he erases things.
He's quite graceful too, and he's graceful about, he can be almost hunched over a smaller guy around the rim, and when that guy jumps to shoot, Embiid, it's almost like he sucks in his entire chest cavity and moves backwards in midair, mm-hmm. but keeps his arms up and doesn't foul. He's very graceful. He was great on Giannis yesterday. Giannis was something bad, 7 of 21 or something like that. I don't have it in front of me. And I picked yesterday. Look, the Sixers made 21 threes yesterday. They may not make 21 threes the rest of the season.
Yep.
Let's be clear about that. Eric Bledsoe didn't play. Let's be clear about that. I picked Philly to make the finals. And look, when you're picking the finals in August or September, it's just like you're throwing shit at the wall. But I do feel like on a fundamental level, they are built to play the Bucks in the playoffs. And that's what Brett Brown said after the game yesterday. So you put Embiid on Giannis. Then when Embiid sits, you put Horford on Giannis and you put Tobias Harris on Brooke Lopez, which I think was smart. And like, look, that's the best you can do. And on the other end of the floor, they had Giannis on Simmons, which means that Wes Matthews was guarding Al Horford. I can't remember if it was Matthews or Middleton. And the other one was guarding Tobias Harris. And like in playoff basketball, like those guys aren't killer post players, but you're going to be able to manufacture some buckets out of those size mismatches. And there's also like the Bucks this year have been playing Giannis at center more than they ever did last year. They can't play that against Embiid. When Embiid is on the floor, you cannot play Giannis at center because he is going to put Giannis in the basket. And he did that. Part of the reason Embiid on Giannis is a favorable matchup for, not favorable, is a matchup they like, is if they get a stop, Giannis is stuck on Embiid on a lot of possessions. And you saw there were two or three possessions where Embiid just put him out of bounds and dunked the ball.
He just doesn't exist, right? Like Embiid at his very best, I think, can be the best player in the world. And there's not a lot of guys who you can say that about. And Giannis is that guy. Giannis can do things. But the other thing you saw in that game, and this is something that we're, this is what, a lot of what the whole Siakam experiment is this year, is how rigorously can you build your shot catalog of your options in terms of plays that you know you can go to in tough situations from 15 feet, from 18 feet, all the Kawhi stuff, right? Giannis has been hitting some threes, and that's a lovely thing, but how well is it built?
Well, I love what Embiid did yesterday because not only did they not guard him, there were a couple where as soon as he looked like he was going to shoot, Embiid was just under the rim. Embiid was just like, you go ahead. We are totally disrespecting you. And it actually is interesting because the Bucks defense is built around playing those kind of mind games with so-so three-point shooters. Like, oh, you're Miles Turner above the break. We're going to let you shoot every single time. We're not going to guard you. And by time five or six, you can see Miles Turner being like, well, I made one, but am I being selfish? Like, do I really want to keep shooting these? And they played that mind game with Giannis. Hey, go ahead, big fella. You're shooting 32%. That's great. I'm going to be over here at the rim because I don't think you can. Now, I think Giannis is impervious to those kind of mind games, but it was fun to see the Sixers play it with him.
The best defenses in the world, and we see this every playoff, allow just shots that the offense doesn't want to take. And that's, you know, that was the beauty of the Kawhi rod, is like he lived in the mid-range for a lot of that and he was great at it, and that's what Siakam is trying to become. It's like, if Philly takes away this and this, am I able to take a 16-footer or, you know, a Dirk imitating one-legged jumper? And there's not, to my eyes, Giannis is so dominant around the rim, so dominant in transition, hitting threes is amazing. But when there's a wall, what's going to happen? And that's going to rely on a lot of Bucks to hit a lot of threes, which can happen, or Giannis to develop his offense to an extent that I think there's another level there. And he could hit it.
Well, and you can see that it's not like he's hopeless the way he shoots.
No, there are going to be games against the, if that playoff series happened, there are going to be two games where he shoots 3 of 7, and the difference between 0 of 7 and 3 of 7 is Bucks win. That's the difference.
But will they be 4, right? And that's the question in that playoff series. And that's where I think the Raptors are probably drawing dead to an extent against Philly because of the size and because Embiid can guard Siakam probably. Siakam, the way he triggers above the break threes now, that may change the game a little bit because he's not scared. But that matchup is so difficult because of Embiid. But with Milwaukee, and again, Milwaukee people who listen to this, like, no one ever respects the Bucks. They were like this in the regular season last year.
I picked the Bucks to beat the Raptors in the playoffs.
And the Bucks, you know, they were up 2-0 and in double overtime.
And so this close. I mean, this close. I'm holding my fingers very, very short apart. Look, there are a lot, all these teams in the East are super interesting. These are the two I've been most interested in because of the fit talent thing. And like Milwaukee has all these, they built a beautiful team around Giannis. Everybody can shoot. They have a bunch of high IQ players. It all fits beautifully. There's a clear hierarchy. Philly has, Ben Simmons is the single most unusual player in the whole league.
Mm-hmm.
He and Joel Embiid don't really complement each other. Their entire rotation is constructed around the reality that those two players do not really complement each other. And yet, Philly just sort of fundamentally believes, that's cool, like, those guys happen to be the guys we drafted, we gotta do our best. And B, like, Simmons may not shoot, may not complement the big fella. You know what he is? 6'10", and unbelievably athletic. And deal with that, Pat Connaughton. Mm-hmm. Deal with that, Sterling Brown. And their view is like, all these dudes, it's like cute that they all shoot threes and they screen and they cut. They're like, they're going to get up against us in a playoff series and they're going to be like, uh-oh, this supernova athlete. Oh, yeah, he doesn't fit and his elbow jumper doesn't work. He's coming at me and I can't do anything. And I want, that's just such an interesting clash of ideas.
There's one tiny thing that I thought about also in that game is, I said earlier, Philly is not a team that cares that much about winning regular season games. They are experimenting with stuff. They are trying stuff. They are resting Embiid. They're not trying to win every game. Giannis tries to win every game. The Raptors are playing so hard. Kyle's playing 40 minutes a night. Long term, if you were trying to win a title this year, that's a bad strategy.
What you said about Gasol maybe applies to Siakam too, because Siakam was playing 42, 43 minutes in some of those games, and like that's not sustainable.
They're trying to win every game, and that's part of why they're so great to watch for Raptors fans, is they play so hard, and they play seven guys a lot of nights, and long term, that's not smart, right? It's not how you try to play a 100-game season, and maybe they're not worried so much about a 100-game season. Maybe they think they just got to stay in this.
I just think that, I mean, look, there are a lot of teams in the East that are going to have something to say about it. As much as I want to see Philly-Milwaukee, you pointed out earlier, there's no guarantee that takes place in the conference finals. That could be the second round. And Philly, because they're weird and because they're going to have a lot of clunky nights, they're vulnerable to be upset by any of these other teams, too. It's no guarantee that it's just them and Milwaukee, obviously. But Milwaukee doesn't force a lot of turnovers. They're not built. They don't play defense to force a lot of turnovers, and that's an Achilles heel of the Sixers. And if the Sixers can get away with 12 turnovers a game, they become that much harder to beat.
The other Bucks thing is there's a stylistic question about how willing they are to adapt to the needs of a particular series. And yes, this has been a long-term concern of Bud. I won't use the Herbie pronunciation of Mike Budenholzer. Shout out to Raptors PA guy, Herbie Kood. He's
Budenholzer.
when he was coaching Atlanta, Dennis Schroeder was on Atlanta. It was a scene at the Air Canada Center. What was that? The Air Canada Center. But like, I think a lot of people, maybe even in Milwaukee, I can't speak to the pulse of that team, probably think in the Raptors series last year, one coach adapted better than the other coach did. And I think there's some validity to it. I wouldn't say that's the reason the Bucks lost and the Raptors won, but it's a reason. And so let's see when Philadelphia forces them out of their comfort zone, how many ways they can play, because I think the Raptors have shown, or especially last year, showed that they could win in a number of different styles. And you don't necessarily need that versatility if you're so dominant in one type of play, but I'm not sure the Bucks will be able to be that unless Giannis just goes supernova, which again is possible.
And also defensively, they're going to be great. They're always good.
The Americans have tied it up, Zach.
Yes, World Juniors, baby. USA. Yes, look at that beautiful goal by that guy. Hockey McPuckington with a wonderful pass there.
That is Leafs draft pick Nick Robertson on the pass.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, the Toronto Maple Leafs just totally dependent on American players at this point. It's a national disgrace.
Don't forget our Danish goalie.
Okay. So the Bucks will play great defense, and I do think, you, to your point, Bruce, about Philly not prioritizing the regular season, I think the Bucks dabbling a little more with Giannis at center is interesting, and I think indicative of them thinking ahead a little bit. And they do stuff in the regular season. Did Canada just go ahead as I'm talking? You know what? I didn't even see it, but there was some penalty there. That
well, sure. My technical analysis of that play without having watched it, because the TV is behind me, is, gosh, the heart on these Canadian kids.
It's in their blood.
Look at these fans. Where is this tournament? It's in Europe.
It's a Czech an industrial town in the Czech Republic.
Whenever they go to Europe, it's always an industrial town. It's a good sign.
I don't even know what I was saying anymore. Giannis defense.
Sorry. Such a barn burner here.
And the Bucks will do things like they'll play lots of minutes in the regular season with Bledsoe, Middleton, and Giannis all on the bench. And I think, although those minutes have been successful and were successful for parts of the Boston series, for instance, last year, I think one of the easiest changes that they have when things get a little tight is to minimize those minutes. And the other question is, how far can they stretch Giannis? Because you saw it last year in the playoffs, like, they're just not willing to make Giannis okay, you're playing 44 minutes tonight. They think how hard he plays and that whatever is best used in like super hard 7 minute, 8 minute spurts, and you come out and like at some point, and we're talking about how you can't play Giannis at center with Joel Embiid on the floor. Well, the easiest way to get to Giannis at center is then play him every minute that Embiid is on the bench. And but does that involve stretching him to 42, 43, 44 minutes a game? Like, to win the championship, he might have to have five games like that in the playoffs.
Flexibility matters. The way the Raptors played a lot of different ways in the playoffs last year. And the way they won that Milwaukee series was by adjusting. And that helps that the adjustment they made, the biggest one was, Kawhi, go get that kid.
Have Kawhi.
Yeah, that's super helpful, right? Like, that's just a nice thing to have in the back pocket.
That Nick Nurse is a genius.
But, I mean, you also look... It'll be really interesting to see if Boston and Miami do something between now and the deadline, because those teams aren't that far away. Like, what does Miami look like if they trade for Kyle Lowry and they, let's say they give up, I don't know, Duncan Robinson and Goran Dragic and James Johnson or whatever. And all of a sudden they got Kyle and they got Jimmy and they got Hero and they got Bam. And they, like, that's a super interesting team.
They're really good. Miami's really good and they're well constructed. They are. The problem is, it's going to be interesting to see if they can find a trade because they have a big expiring contract. Mm-hmm. They can trade a first. I think they're allowed to trade. They can trade their first available first 2 years after they're out two, but they can trade 2 years after the last one, I believe. And they do have Justice Winslow, who they are winning without, and has a handy dandy $13 million contract. But they really like Justice Winslow, and they should. Without him going in a deal, I'm not sure they have the juice to get anyone good. But they have some trade pieces that makes sense for a team that's trying to go all in. Speaking of Miami, I thought this would be a good excuse to pick or to talk about Eastern Conference All-Stars, because All-Star voting opened yesterday, and I'm going to have to write an All-Star column at some point. And as I dug into it, I was like, this is actually kind of fun. The East the East is really weird. So we're talking about all these teams.
Anyway. What were our, like, 12th man conversations last year? I'm trying to remember. D'Angelo Russell.
Got in.
Yeah, Pascal Siakam. Most improved Pascal Siakam was a consideration. It was. I mean, we've had some questionable Eastern Conference All-Stars. Not to besmirch any of them specifically.
A lot of besmirching there.
See, I'm all about the half measures. I just want to apologize for everything. Just further reinforcing stereotypes about Canadians.
So, the East is unusual in that there are five stone cold locks that I'm going to pencil in as the starting five of the All-Star team. Positions be damned, because I think they will let us do this. Kemba Walker, Jimmy Butler, I hope they make him eligible at guard and forward. So he's my other guard. Giannis, Siakam, and Joel Embiid. That's it. Now, Siakam's injured, but he played so well that if he gets whatever X more games under his belt by the time we have to finalize this, he's in. So that's five. We got seven reserves. There's like 20 dudes who are on a giant bubble, and part of the reason this is unusually interesting to me is two of them in particular are putting up monstrous numbers on really, really bad teams. Mm-hmm. And one of those guys is a past All-Star, I believe, a two-time All-Star, and that's Bradley Beal. And the other one is Trae Young. So let me read you some names. Here are 14 names. Keep it. And by the way, this is even trimming some of the fat. Trae Young, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Ben Simmons, Tobias Harris, Spencer Dinwiddie, Bam Adebayo, Domantas Sabonis, Malcolm Brogdon, Kyle Lowry, Bradley Beal, Fred VanVleet, Chris Middleton. And then you get into Devontae Graham, Andre Drummond, Zach LaVine, Evan Fournier. Guys, I'm not gonna concern myself so much with some of those guys. You can make an argument, I guess, for an Andre Drummond or a Zach LaVine if you want. Some people will. That's a lot of dudes. And it also takes us into territory of, like, and I normally resist this kind of discussion with All-Star, but I think it's interesting this year of, like, does X team deserve two? Does X team deserve three? Does any team deserve three? Does Indiana absolutely have to have one of Sabonis and Brogdon get on? Does Miami deserve a second All-Star with Bam? I don't know. There are no right answers to those questions. I typically find them the deserve wording sort of uninteresting. But either one of you, I just named a lot of dudes. There are lots of ways you can go. Trey and Beal and losing teams. If Boston gets one, who should it be? A second one behind Kemba, who should it be? If Indiana gets one, who should it be? What is of that is interesting to you?
I mean, it's really difficult for all the reasons you just mentioned. So I'm sort of inclined to just start naming players I think need to be there as of now.
That's what I thought as well. Yeah. It feels funny. Like,
yeah.
If this guy's not here, it feels funny.
And the other thing that occurs to me, and I don't think it's a particularly interesting conversation to have right now, but the coaches picked the reserves. So there is a natural bias, I would say, toward veteran players who have done this before and they've had to scheme around multiple times.
There's a bias to there and to winning teams.
Yeah, and that's where I think Trae Young might lose out on this. Is if I was just handicapping this now, I would guess Trae Young would not make the All-Star team.
He's not on your needs to be there list.
No.
Okay.
So just looking at the list I have, I think Bam Adebayo is an All-Star.
He needs to be there. He needs to be there.
Yeah.
That's my number one add to the list guy.
Revving up the Bam wagon.
He's really good.
I think Kemba's there.
Bam is number one on your list? I love Bam. I'm very excited by this development.
Of the guys that, like, of the second guy that you're going to add off a team, off one of the good teams, I think Bam just does so many things. He's such a high-impact defender. Like,
so he's 16-11-5, 57% shooting.
And elite defense.
His advanced stats are like outrageously good.
He's so good.
The best of all of these guys.
Yeah.
For your mileage on those may vary. Okay, so I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eric.
I think Kemba needs to be there.
Well, he's already in. He's in my top five.
He's not a starter. Butler is the starter in our...
Kemba, Butler.
I thought it was... Sorry. Am I messing this up now? I thought it was Butler... Never mind. I'm the idiot here. Okay.
No one's an idiot. I don't like that word. Everyone is trying their best.
Not everyone.
Okay. So
I think Beal needs to be there. I think what he's doing is because of his, I mean, the Washington Wizards don't play much defense, but I think Beal at least tries. And maybe this is me exhibiting the same bias as coaches will in that, like, he's been effective on that end before, and therefore, if the Wizards suck on defense, it's not his fault.
28-7 is hard to ignore.
Yeah. So I think Beal's there, and I'm not sure which... I think Simmons is there, too.
Over Harris?
Yes. To me, he is. I think he has more of an impact night in and night out. Canada has beaten the United States. Sorry about
that. 6-4.
And one of Young and Brown is definitely there. Both might be there.
Brown and Tatum.
The Young Celtics. And I was looking at the name Trae Young. This confused me. One of Brown and Tatum is there. I can't decide which one. And so I'll maybe leave that off to you.
I'll tell you who I'm leaning towards right now. I'm leaning towards Jaylen Brown.
Hmm.
The shooting numbers aren't close. 39% on threes, 58% on twos. Advanced stats are better. I think Tatum is actually probably going to be a better player just in the sense of he's so much more polished on offense that, and you can see this in Brad Stevens' rotations, they trust him more to run, kind of be the number one guy when Kemba Walker rests than they do Jaylen Brown. And the plus minus numbers reflect that. They are plus 13 with Tatum on the floor and minus 3 when he's off the floor, which is one of the biggest net differences in the league, much bigger than Jaylen's. And I think here's a medium take. I think Jason Tatum has been as good or better on defense this season as Jaylen Brown. Hmm. I think Jason Tatum has become a really, really good defensive player. But I think Jaylen has had a slightly better season, so I'm leaning Jaylen. Can we talk about Trae Young?
Sure. I don't have like a lot of strong takes on Trae Young, other than I guess he shouldn't make the All-Star team, which is maybe a strong take around the league.
29 points and 9 assists per game, and you're leaving Trae Young.
Yeah, well, you roasted him in your 10 things column the other day for his defense, and that was not good. That didn't help his cause. You're the hater here.
He is averaging 29-9. His offensive advanced statistics are outrageously good, and he is an outrageously good offensive player. The Hawks, without him, are almost better off just taking shot clock violations on offense. They're so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so people will use that as a way to back Trae Young's case. In response to those people, I would say the Hawks roster is awful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awful somewhat by design. DeAndre Hunter and Cam Reddish are not supposed to be good. They're rookies. Now, mm-hmm. Cam Reddish has been a disappointment so far, but it's very early. It's but, you know, it's just super early. They should be bad. Their second best player has been suspended almost the entire season. They have seemingly half of their roster spots are being used up on cap fodder or broken players or old players. Like, so am I really giving Trae Young quote unquote credit because the team is so bad when he doesn't play? I'm not giving him any credit for that. That's nice that they're a decent offense when he plays. Defensively, they are so bad with him on the floor, and he is reason number one that they are so bad with him on the floor. And I will say this.
Zach means this.
I don't care that Trae Young is young. I don't care. You can tell, oh, point guard defense doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he tries. James Harden doesn't try. Luka Doncic doesn't try. You can go on and on. First of all, those guys are bigger and stronger, so just by definition, they're going to be better, even if their effort is bad. Trae Young does not try. And I have learned enough about the NBA to know that when your best player mails it in on defense, mm-hmm. that can have – I'm not saying it's happening in Atlanta, but that can have a corrosive effect on a locker room. And I just – I need to see – I actually am leaning to putting Trae Young in the All-Star game as much as I'm saying all this stuff that makes my stomach turn. But if he makes my final roster, it's going to be as one of the very last spots because I just – I don't – He's a really great offensive player. I have to keep coming back on that reality. He's a really, yeah. truly great offensive player.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that the other end were not so bad.
This isn't a direct comparison, obviously. And I hate to single out Jeremy Lin. But when Jeremy Lin came from Atlanta last year, they really thought he was going to be a useful player for them. And he got into the Raptors kind of practices and he wasn't at that level. He wasn't a guy who's been a really great competitor in his career, wasn't at that level. And that's why Jeremy Lin wasn't even a question. When Fred VanVleet was missing 100 straight shots, there was no thought of putting Jeremy Lin in the game. And the theory was there wasn't a single Atlanta Hawks game that had mattered. And that eventually, it atrophies some of your competitive reflexes. Other teams don't take the Atlanta Hawks seriously. They don't. That's the worst team in the league. And so I wonder, I think he's still a great offensive player, and put on the right team, there's no question he's an all-star. It's hard to say how much of his production is because other teams don't care about the Atlanta Hawks because they don't need to.
Yeah, I mean, having watched him play against the Raptors and a few other games, what he does out there is like elite all-star special stuff.
I'm leaning towards putting him in.
I'm looking at this list and like those were the guys I know I want to put on. So that's, you know.
But then I just run out of guys.
Yeah. Like we were talking about how good it is. And then we're done at nine.
A Celtic has to be there. I think, I don't really normally buy these arguments, but I think a Pacer needs to be.
I think it's Sabonis.
I do too. And I actually polled a bunch of people in the last couple of days, including some players that were there last night, and Brogdon won out in the poll. Mm. I get that. Brogdon's the offensive engine. He's handling the ball. I think Sabonis is what makes them tick night to night. I think the inside-outside game that he brings in terms of his playmaking from the elbows and all that in the screen and roll game, I would lean... Again, I have a month before I decide, but I would lean a little bit towards Sabonis. But I think one of them has to get in. A Sixer needs to get in. Another Sixer needs to get in. Simmons or Harris. Apologies to Al Horford. Bam, it's going to be interesting. But if you think Bam is going to get in, then there's another spot.
That wasn't as much a prediction as I think he should be there.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think.
And we know the All-Star game is always about pure meritocracy.
Well, in my construction of the roster,
all of capitalism is.
Despite the fact that he's shooting 31% from three, Spencer Dinwiddie has made a really, really strong case keeping the Nets above water with mm-hmm. a roster that without LeVert and without Kyrie Irving is very, very short on like average talent. When their bench is in the game, it's like, oh boy. And I think if he keeps playing like he has in the last week, I think your boy Kyle Lowry is going to get in.
I was just going to say.
As a second all-star. And then we're running out of spots. And that means we're running out of, one of the Pacers doesn't make it. Middleton doesn't make it. Van Vliet doesn't make it. Maybe Trey doesn't make it. There's just a lot of interesting things. But I think Lowry, if Lowry carries this team to an okay record in the next 2 to 3 weeks, he's going to make the All-Star team.
He's playing at such a high level right now. And you could see it even at the start of that Christmas Day game. You could see the confidence he's got. He's been worthy of an All-Star slot despite missing the games, I would say. But then you look, so what's the list we've got? We've got Bam. Let's say we've got Simmons for the Sixers. You got Beal. You got Dinwiddie and Lowry. You got a second Celtic and a Pacer. That's, with your starters, I believe, 12 guys. Like, it gets tight fast.
I think it's really, and the Bucks fans are going to say, well, how can we be so good and get one All-Star? To which I say, Middleton, if you want to put Middleton in, that's fine. He's already 19 a game, shooting the hell out of it at 30-something last night on Christmas. I just don't think it's guaranteed.
You have the MVP, and he's awesome.
Yeah, you have. That's the construction of your team.
He's worth two All-Stars.
You have one A++++ guy and, like, a bunch of good players.
The Dirk Nowitzki, and this is no disrespect to the Bucks. The Dirk Nowitzki title team, I don't think, had two All-Stars.
Well, you remember the year when Dan Gilbert released a bunch of adjectives about Mo Williams not making the All-Star team? It was like he was so outraged.
Dan Gilbert is, you were so outraged one time
that
all the other times you were outraged, people forget. Like, I forgot about this happened because all people remember is Comic Sans. I don't remember it. Dan Gilbert.
Yeah, Mo Williams, I think like they released a press conference and it was in like one of the LeBron and the LeBronette years the first time around. When like they were dominating the league, much like the Bucks are, and it's like, well, we're 32-5. How do we not have a second All-Star? And it's because you have the best player in the world, and he's playing like the best player in the world, and he's unstoppable. And like looking back, was Mo Williams? Now in the Eastern Conference, you can make a case that he probably. I don't want to do a Mo Williams retrospective there, but
why not?
But he was like a fine player who hit some open shots and was like an okay secondary creator, and you know that's not what you think of when you think All-Star. Like Trey Young is an All-Star before Chris Middleton is to me. Even if neither ends up making it on my fictional list, which doesn't exist, but it's so difficult. And I think the All-Star game is for the best players in the conference, and I just think that somebody like Young is slightly more meaningful than Middleton.
Well, here's a question. Hold on. So is Middleton, would you take him ahead of Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum?
Right now, no.
And see, so that drops him down. So that's where you get the second Celtic. Would you take him ahead of a Pacer, either Brogdon or Sabonis?
No.
And so that drops him down. And then he's not ahead of Beal. I don't think he's ahead of Lowry. He's not ahead of Simmons. He's not ahead of Bam.
Lowry and Trae Young are such interesting contrasts, and it's unfair to Trae Young because, again, he is a special offense player, and he is very, no pun intended, young. But one guy, I mean, this is the story of Kyle Lowry's career. One guy will put up stats that you don't even look twice at, and that if you watch the game, you're like, this guy is the reason this team is winning. And the other guy is going to put up monster stats, and you will watch the game and say, well, he's the reason they're functional on one end and the reason they're dysfunctional on the other end. How does that net out? And Middleton is like, what is the most valuable thing you can have in basketball is an offensive engine, a true number one offensive engine that is going to make us functional on that end against everybody. And Trae Young is that. I can't wait till the Hawks have a little more talent around him and they can, you know, for all the comparisons between Trae Young and Steph Curry, they haven't, or Trae hasn't, become useful away from the ball as a screener and spacer and cutter the way that Steph was, and that elevated Steph and the Warriors to legend status. Trae Young is that kind of offensive engine. Chris Middleton is not, but Chris Middleton is a nice defensive player. I don't know how that all nets out and like who's more helpful to try to win a championship this year. I don't really know, but I think Trae Young. It'd be interesting to see how the coaches treat his
candidates. The coaches are going to vote Kyle Lowry in before they vote Trae Young in, is my strong inkling.
I think we just have to accept, and specifically,
I love that we live in a world now that coaches love Kyle Lowry, by the way. There is some level of irony.
There is a little bit of irony there. Well, a lot of them don't have to coach him and never did. But you have to accept the reality that Milwaukee's going to be mad about a lot of things until they either win a title and or Giannis resigns. That there is going to be persistent and escalating grievance in Milwaukee, and some of it will be deserved because the team is really good, because everyone wants to talk about where Giannis might play in 2021, even though we're still sitting here and we haven't reached 2020 yet. All these things, this is life with having a guy like that. And Toronto's about to go through that with Masai Ujiri for 2 years or a year and a half.
We didn't even talk about that.
As to what happens there, because he's Toronto's Giannis, essentially. They're free agents at the same time. But this is what life is like when you have this guy.
I remember a GM being the subject of this sort of tantalizing, titillating, what is he going to do coverage ever in the NBA. I'm sure there was one, and I'm just forgetting it. But the what is Masai going to do is a very... It's interesting to see how that story evolves.
No one ever did this with R.C. Buford, you know? Like, no one ever said, well, I mean, there's been stories over the years. A team has interest in so-and-so and that kind of thing. But Masai is different, man.
I guess there's no Duncan here, right? I mean, Siakam is going to be a star and will be a star for a long time, but I don't think you look at Siakam as like, Tim Duncan's one of the 10
best players. He's not a generational.
Yeah, Tim Duncan's one of the 10 best players ever.
And what he's built, like when we go back to if we circle back to the beginning of this conversation, what you see from the Raptors this year is a team that had every reason to not be good, coasting on a championship, played too much in the summer, lost their best player, lost their starting two guard, barely added anybody of consequence because they were waiting for those guys. And what you've seen is the result of a team that drafts exceptionally well, that develops exceptionally well.
In some cases, doesn't even draft exceptionally well. They just whatever not drafting is, they do that exceptionally well.
Well, I mean, Pascal Siakam's at 27. Norm's a second round pick. Like, these guys, so many parts of this system work. It is a championship level organization. And the Masai Ujiri is the guy who came in here when it wasn't and has built that over a series of years. And he's one of the rock stars in the league, and that's part of life as defending champs too.
Yeah, the rock star part is a bit of the equation here because he, in so many ways, like you said, he's the face of the franchise, mm-hmm. and he imbues you as an executive with confidence. Like Mitch Kupchak, who won several championships with the Lakers, went to Charlotte and like. We see how that's gone. And
it's who's not, going to Charlotte and fixing that?
Yeah, but it's not at all the same thing. Like, there just aren't many executives, not only with that cachet, because I think, like, Danny Ainge has that, mm-hmm. and we can name a few others, but also that knows how to, like, ignite a fan base just with his presence. It's a strange thing, and it's part of who he is. It's part of the package.
It's partly because he did it here. And I've covered this team... My first game was in 2002. It was the game where Chris Childs forgot the score. That was my first game. And I believe we discussed it before. Keon Clark was smoking a cigarette in the showers afterwards. Like it was quite a scene. For so many years, you couldn't win an NBA title in Toronto. It was impossible to think that you could win an NBA title here because of the way the league works, because of how the players view Toronto, because of where superstars want to play, especially in the superstar team building era. In the Miami Heat, LeBron, Boston Celtics, Big Three, in that era, how are you going to build a title contender here even? And he did it. And if Kawhi Leonard had stayed, they'd be the favorites to win the title again this year, I swear.
We will see what happens with Masai. I want to do one more thing on the Sixers. If you have to pick Simmons or Harris, you pick Simmons?
Yeah.
Simmons or Harris?
Yeah, I think so. Ben, like his defense is still underrated, I would say.
Ben is averaging 15, 9, and 7. Those are good numbers. Mm-hmm. The 9 and 7 parts are really good, and he leads the league in steals. Tobias is averaging 20.7 rebounds, 3 assists. The advanced numbers all favor Ben in a landslide. And yet Harris, to me, feels like he's just his shooting, his shot creation for as just B-level as it is, mm-hmm. and his ability to float between every kind of lineup that they play, the Simmons only lineups, the Embiid only lineups, it feels so essential to their team.
Oh, absolutely.
And he is super duper bought into defense. He has to guard threes a lot. Sometimes he even guarded Korver yesterday against the Bucks and held up pretty well chasing him around. That was not his strong suit, guarding shorter, smaller, faster players. Mm-hmm. And he's done it well and he's bought in. He's played really good defense this year. Good defense. But again, and Simmons, we all know what the limitations are. We all know there's going to be one game every four games or one game every three games where Sixers fans are like, is he a star? What is he? What is he doing? Is he just standing there? Why doesn't he shoot? He scored 8 points. What blah. But his, I keep using the word supernova. His athleticism and his vision is just, and those 9 assists, those aren't like bring the ball up, somebody comes off a pin down, like every dude in the league could throw that pass. Mm-hmm. They are assists that he is creating from scratch by rebounding the ball, pushing the ball up and getting, so I think and his defense, I think right now he'd be on one of my two all defense teams. His defense has been unbelievable.
One thing, after 4 games of that Philly Raptors series last year, one of the Philly guys turned to me and went, Ben is playing all NBA defense in this series and Kawhi is doing that. And he literally looked at me and said, he can't keep this up, can he? Like, they were spooked by Kawhi after 4 games. And it turns out they were right to be. But like, Ben is a high, high end defensive player, and he gets overshadowed like he does in every other way by Embiid.
The last thing I will say is wrap on your point about the East and Sixers. You said the Sixers need another shooter. I think how they resolve that debate, and it's very much a debate within their organization, is going to be very, very interesting, because it's an easy thing to say.
Sure is.
Okay. But what, so when they play with Simmons and not Embiid, and Embiid and not Simmons, so one of them is on the floor, they have plenty of shooting. All 4 of those other guys can shoot. You're really talking about the lineups when both of them play. They could use a little more shooting. But then you have to ask the question, it's like, okay, who is the shooter? And who is he playing over? Is he playing over Richardson? Is he playing over Harris? Is he playing over Horford? And the answer is, what they really need is a better sixth man. Shooter or not shooter, they need one guy who they can plug in. If Horford's having a bad day, or the matchups are bad for Harris, or the matchups are bad for Richardson, or Simmons is really just off and not working with Embiid, they need a guy they can plug into their closing lineup and say, yeah, this guy can shoot, but he's also good enough that he belongs in this lineup and he's not going to get targeted on the other end. And I'm not sure who that player is, but I know that I would be very careful of just pursuing shooting for shooting's sake, because you're really just talking about one kind of lineup. Now, it's an important one, albeit. And I'm not sure what good that shooter does if when he's on the floor, the other team is like, oh, good. One of the best defenses in the league has a weak spot we can pick at now.
Matisse.
Maybe that's their shooter.
He's shooting he hasn't taken a lot of them. He's shooting 46% from 3.
Look, if that dude can shoot, it's a problem.
You know, I watched him when they came to town, just watching it. His release is still a little bit funky, but he started to hit him a little bit, and he's an elite defensive player in his own way. Like,
I just think how they resolve that. Like, man, if you go out and get,
just saying,
the Sixers are sort of obsessed internally, I think, with how beneficial Bellinelli and Ilyasova were to their team 2 seasons ago, and like recreating that acquisition. Like, that was great. It worked well for them. Mm-hmm. They also lost in the second round, and those guys are eminently targetable. At least Bellinelli is on defense. It will be very interesting because they don't have much to work with anyway. They're just under the tax, and they'd have to trade one of their starters to get someone really, really good. But they have Mike Scott plus some stuff can get you to a $10 million-ish player.
Yeah, you don't need a one-way shooter, and I wasn't trying to suggest. I mean,
no, I'm not
sure
you are.
If it doesn't cost anything, take a one-way shooter. It's fine. But
Jason Capono.
I said shooter, not theoretical shooter. That's some deep Raptors.
That's a deep Raptors cut where Jason Capono would not take shots, which would suppress
team.
His field goal percentage.
The Sixers are 5th or 6th in the league in 3-point shooting. Now, they don't take very many. They're 25th in attempts. And it's why I watch all these teams zoning them up. And, yeah, they struggled horribly when Miami did it. But defenses that encourage the Sixers to shoot threes, I'm not sure, like, awesome ideas going. I mean, I can see why they work, but the Sixers take a ton of mid-range jumpers, and when they don't, they become a higher variance team, but one that can have a game like they had yesterday and just blow the doors off you.
Yeah. It's tough to get those guys. I mean, that's the reality. I'm not even sure who that guy is in this market.
I could see them going to get, I don't even want to make up a shooter, some one-dimensional shooter, and everyone be like, oh boy.
Yeah.
And then
he's playing 10 minutes a game.
Yeah, and then you get to the playoffs oh, this guy can't be on the floor in this series.
Yeah. I mean, we saw a lot of James Ennis. We saw a lot of, Mike Scott, who is the best player in the league against the Raptors. So that's not exactly
those
fair.
Dudes can shoot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're fine.
Korkmaz can shoot.
So you're looking for somebody better than that. And those guys cost a lot in terms of assets. And so we'll see if they can acquire it.
Top of the East is awesome. Right now, Toronto is still in the top of the East, which is a great story all of in itself, because when Kawhi left, I thought they'd be good. Nice little cute fifth, sixth seed. And technically they are that, but they're better than that. And the way they've withstood injuries is awesome. And the fans here seem to really dig this team.
I mean, just to wrap that up, like, just as somebody who has to cover the team, I was sort of dreading this regular season. It's like, I just covered a finals run, and now I sort of know what the ceiling is going to be on this team. And I still think I mostly know that, but the day-to-day effort has been so fun to watch, and there's been so many fun subplots, as you mentioned, Chris Boucher, Terrence Davis, Van Vliet and Siakam taking extra steps, that like each game is interesting in and of itself. And whereas the last few years, even going back to pre-Kawhi, it was like very much what's going to happen in the playoffs. Now there's still that question, but it's not the defining question in the way that it has been.
Yeah, well, like, there's the experience of sports fandom is essentially unrewarding for the vast majority of fans if you measure it by championships, right? Like, it's just, if you're lucky, you might be truly happy once in 20 years, and take almost any sport for most franchises. And the Raptors got that. The Raptors got there once in 20, 25 years. And the funny thing, what you said, Kareen, is that the ceiling on this, like, they're not that different from what we thought they would be. Like, they're a good team that's probably one superstar away from being a great team. It's the simplest math in the world. Like, when the playoffs start, they won't be favored against Philadelphia or Milwaukee. Or maybe Boston or
Boston,
Miami.
Boston will be favored. Like, Boston will be favored. Like, Miami, that's interesting, actually.
Like, it's, they lack a true 100% superstar, and see, the part of the season is watching Siakam and see how close he can become to that. But this team has been so admirable. And again, it might come back to bite them because you can't play Kyle 40 minutes and all this stuff. This is a championship organization. That's what this comes down to. And the habits and the good things about that championship run that weren't Kawhi Leonard are still on full display. And for Raptors fans, it does get better than this. They know that. It just did. But it doesn't get much better than this.
No, it's cool. And these games are rewarding. And all right, I have to go because I need to figure out who needs to get fired for this World Junior Hockey debacle that Team USA is just suffering. I need to go analyze the game, break it down. Eric Kareen, read all his stuff at The Athletic. He's covering all things Raptors. Bruce Arthur, read all his stuff at Toronto Star. He's probably going to be covering World Junior Hockey, but you can read that too. And he'll cover some Raptors. Guys, this is a wonderful annual holiday tradition. The next version of this tradition is we go out to a bar like normal human beings and have some beverages and watch a game. So let's do that. But in the meantime, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having us, Zach.
It's always a pleasure, and I'm sorry we don't have any tobogganing snow this year.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.